And the worst thing that can happen to the industry is this thing opens in a little over 5 years' time, and we provide a really poor service, which is not reliable and doesn't and provides less seats than today. That will completely undermine any case for building more lines in the UK and will become a global embarrassment.
Welcome to Freewheeling, the free-thinking podcast about moving forward faster. My name's Thomas Abelman, and each week I'll bring you fresh voices, new ideas, and unconventional thinking. So let's get started now with this week's edition of the Freewheeling podcast. When asked his profession, my guest this week simply describes himself as a railwayman. In his 40 years on the railways, Chris Gibb has run, in slightly different forms, the Welsh National Railway, the Scottish National Railway, and the closest thing that we have to an English National Railway, the sprawling cross-country franchise that connects every corner of our nation. He started out as a British Rail clerk in Croydon and ended up spending 4 years trying to get a high-speed railway built across Texas. He's currently non-exec director of the government agency that runs the nationalised English rail franchises. But none of that's why Chris Gibb is joining me today. The experience I've failed to mention is that Chris spent 6 years as MD of Virgin West Coast, the rail franchise connecting Euston, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool and Glasgow, the very route that HS2 was intended to replicate. And when HS2 got cancelled, Chris's brain kicked into gear. Today's episode is all about exploring what that prodigious brain generated. Chris Gibb, welcome to the Freewheeling podcast.
Hello, welcome, Thomas.
Thank you. So it has been quite a career. We'll come on to HS2 later. We'll talk a bit about what happened, and then we'll talk about what you propose to do about it, what you want to be done about it. But just looking back over the last 40 years, if I was going to make a film of the life of Chris Gibb, what would the moments be that would make it onto the trailer?
Wow, what a question. Well, enthusiasm and a big smile, because I've loved everything I've done in my entire career, and I've learned from every job I've done. I think the most fulfilling moment was walking across the concourse at Glasgow Central as a train crew supervisor one Blackpool Fair weekend, when I think we ran 12 extra trains from Glasgow to Blackpool at very short notice, and working with the hundreds of ex-steam age drivers and the Glasgow train crew population, which was an extremely rewarding period of my career and very satisfying. I learned pretty much everything I needed for my career in that one job.
I remember very similarly when I was at Wrexham and Shropshire, and we ran something like 6 times our normal daily capacity when Shrewsbury Town got into this is where I know they were playing a football match. What the football match? I didn't know, but they all seemed to think it mattered an awful lot. And there was a lot of demand to travel to Wembley Stadium that day. So we basically drained Shrewsbury of people, taking them to Wembley. And one of the things that strikes me about all the various railways you've been involved in is complexity. And I think this links to some of the things we're going to talk about with HS2 later. You've always been involved in railways that are doing far more than they were originally built to do. Is that something that you've noticed as well?
Yes, it is. You know, when I joined the railway, it was on its knees, and I didn't imagine I'd be able to have a career. In my first few jobs, I made people redundant, you know, not just 2 or 3 people, but hundreds of people. And I watched bits of the railway closing down. We lost huge traffic, such as the milk trains, the newspaper trains. The whole nighttime railway basically went to sleep. And I've watched it recover from that very, very low point to the point where before COVID, everybody was saying the railway is full, and we were the victim of our own success with overcrowding and poor punctuality, a consequence of a system that was absolutely at its limits. Of course, since COVID, everything has changed again, and the whole makeup of what the railway does is different. So, yeah, I've seen it, and I've played a part in stretching it to its utmost during my career.
What would you say the secret has been of why, you know, that journey took place? Why was there a fall, and why has there been a recovery?
Well, I think the fall occurred for a number of reasons: growing car ownership, the railway doing doing a poor job of a lot of things that it did, a good job on some things, but it was always a cycle down towards the bottom. We lost a lot of freight traffic to road, for example. We lost a lot of passenger traffic to not only car, but domestic air and coach travel. How did we recover? Well, when the railway was privatised, it was privatised, in my opinion, on the basis that it would quietly decline in following years. And the whole privatisation structure was set up to manage ongoing decline. But what we found very soon after privatisation was that the only way for the companies to remain profitable and to make a profit was to attract more passengers. So they set about attracting more custom, raising more revenue, filling empty trains. And they were rather good at that on most routes. And we saw steady growth in passenger numbers. Meanwhile, the road network was getting more and more congested, and people were considering the environment for the first time in their choice of journeys. So a lot of things that the railway caused to happen, and some that happened to the railway, brought about that reversal. And the growth in passenger numbers was higher than pretty much every country in Europe, which certainly confounded the prophets of doom.
One of the things I find fascinating is the fact that the numbers tell their own story. Privatisation was not a failure, because exactly as you say, the levels of usage in the railway pretty much hit their trough just before privatisation and hit their peak just before COVID. So it worked. Passengers made their own decisions. But if you talk to people outside the industry, there's a pretty widespread consensus that privatisation was a failure. They don't consider that they've been attracted back onto the railways, but the numbers tell you that they have. Why do you think we got this differential between how people think it went and what visibly actually happened?
Well, a number of reasons. I mean, for a start, the railway became so full that we struggled to meet passenger expectations. Basic stuff like punctuality, getting a seat, things like that became a nice to have almost as the railway got so full. And our ability to change the product that we were offering was poor. And we didn't respond to the growth numbers, held back by a number of factors. We were unable to provide more seats, more carriages, more trains, all of these sort of things at the rate that we were attracting more passengers. I think also latterly towards COVID, we lost the trust of the passengers. The passengers became convinced that the private sector was squirreling away large amounts of money, paying huge dividends to its owners and giving back very little in return for that. And after 25 years, I think the franchising system had become exhausted. If you won a franchise, your share price often went down because it was assumed that you'd got the numbers wrong in your bid. Whereas at the beginning, if you won a franchise, your share price went up. So the system, the way in which franchises were awarded, just had exhausted itself. And all too often, a franchise was awarded to somebody who had got their numbers wrong, and it all ended in tears.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you mentioned that the network was struggling to deal with capacity and providing people a seat. And of course, HS2 was meant to be a big part of the answer to that. Do you think, I mean, a lot of people do, I think I certainly do, think that part of the original sin of HS2 was calling it High Speed 2, and the fact that the key objective of providing more capacity on the West Coast line was not visible to people who support was needed, primarily the taxpayers who were being asked to pay for it?
Well, I think at the beginning, the logic was sound. We had High Speed 1. The Secretary of State at the time, Lord Adonis, wanted to expand on that. He was a passionate believer in high-speed rail, and there was hankering at the time for more high-speed lines. We'd got High-Speed 1. It was clearly a success. People were using it. People were going to Europe on it. The vision was to build more high-speed lines, but we failed to articulate that it wasn't just about high speed, and it was very much about capacity, not just the West Coast Main Line, of course. The original High Speed 2 was the way of providing more capacity for the East Coast Main Line and the Midland Main Line as well. So at least three lines stood to benefit from building High Speed 2. And we just didn't get that across as an industry faced with an extremely articulate opposition. You know, one has to remember that it was decided by government to build this new railway through some of the most affluent parts of the London suburbs. People stood to go from having a quiet enjoyment of their countryside to having a 200 plus mile an hour train running almost at the end of their garden. And I say that as somebody who lives close to the route myself. So we took on that opposition without enough logic and without enough of a case on the capacity front. And of course, most of those people, if you take the area from about Ryslip up to Kenilworth, stood to gain very little, in their opinion, from the construction of High Speed 2. You know, I've had that conversation with people who live in Milton Keynes. You know, I've said to them, in Milton Keynes, you will benefit hugely from High Speed 2. Well, how? We don't have a station anywhere near Milton Keynes. But the answer is, of course, you'll get a seat on your train from Milton Keynes to London. And you could have a train every 7 minutes between Milton Keynes and London non-stop, because that railway is no longer carrying as many people to Scotland or Manchester or North Wales or Liverpool. Instead, it's focusing very much on urban transport between Milton Keynes and London. Now, that's quite a complex argument to get across, especially when faced with the articulate opposition that has been aimed at High Speed 2 since its inception.
All right, so let's remind ourselves of the original plan for it, first of all, shall we? So we start out with a effectively brand new station at Euston. We run west to Old Oak Common to connect with the Great Western Line. Then we turn through the zone you said, the zone where people suffer but don't benefit, that huge sway through the Chiltern Hills, through Ryslip, from Ryslip to Kenilworth, through the Chilterns and through Warwickshire, where we hit Birmingham, and we have a massive new station in Birmingham as a sort of central hub for the UK. And then, of course, there was going to be a whole eastern leg as well that we almost have forgotten was ever planned. Do you want to talk about that a bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think in the original plans, even Old Oak Common wasn't part of that original plan. It soon became a plan because people wanted connections to Heathrow, and indeed people wanted a through service to Heathrow and to High Speed 1 to be able to go on to Europe. But going back to what was originally proposed in formal process, there was a line reaching from the Midlands towards Derby, going probably through Sheffield, or I don't think that was ever resolved fully, on to Leeds and York, with through trains continuing to Newcastle. So it would have served the whole of the north of England and provided very useful, very fast journeys between, for example, the East Midlands near Nottingham and Leeds, probably about a quarter of the journey time that it takes today. So it wasn't just about high speed to and from London. It was also about capacity for intermediate journeys.
That's something that is often forgotten, isn't it? I mean, the journey between Nottingham and Leeds is embarrassingly slow at the moment. You know, connecting two major cities, stopping at small market towns all along the way. And that would have been solved by HS2. But as you say, never really became part of the public narrative for it. And then the other branch was the branch that was due to duplicate the West Coast to Manchester, and effectively another brand new station at Manchester Piccadilly with connections back onto the West Coast for services up to Scotland and a connection through to Liverpool, towards Liverpool.
Yeah, and you know, one of the first bits to be cancelled was the so-called Goulbourne link that took you onto the West Coast main line near Warrington and would have significantly reduced journey time from Glasgow to London. You know, it's often forgotten that although the High Speed 2 new line went from London to Birmingham, that the through trains would carry on as far afield as Scotland, Manchester, Liverpool, and all of these cities would benefit. Obviously, passengers wouldn't need to change trains. They'd be sitting on a train on a conventional railway line in Scotland, and then as it went further south, they'd end up on the high-speed line. just as pretty much every country in Europe does. You know, I think some of the best examples are Italy, Spain, France, Germany. They've all got substantial high-speed networks, and that's before you even mention China. You know, all of these countries have recognised the need to provide more capacity, and that the best way of doing that in many cases is to build a new high-speed line.
As you say, the high-speed trains connect places, you know, right down in the bottom right-hand of Italy, in Puglia, stations like Lecce, served by high-speed trains. They're nowhere near the high-speed line, but the train runs onto the high-speed line during its journey, and you can go all the way to Milan on a direct high-speed train, even if you haven't got a high-speed line all the way. And it was exactly the same vision for this, as you say, Glasgow or Edinburgh connected via the East Coast and the West Coast main line in the north, but connecting onto the high-speed line in the south.
Slightly different in that in Italy, a lot of those through services are provided by tilting Pendolino trains that go at the maximum possible speed on the older railway and the maximum speed on the high speed lines, where they don't tilt, but they're able to run at 155 miles an hour. So they make the most of both the older railway and the new railway. The proposal for high speed too is to remove the tilting trains on Glasgow to London and use slower non-tilting trains that can go slightly faster on high speed too. So, you know, I question whether we're learning the lessons from Italy, where I think they've got it about right.
I feel like that might just be a spoiler for later in the conversation. Excellent. So let's roll forward then to last year. So by the autumn of last year, the Goulburn link had already been cancelled, so you weren't going to be able to get a train straight off the high-speed line in Greater Manchester and continue up to Scotland. That had gone. The high-speed connection to High Speed 1, that had gone. The whole of the eastern leg towards Nottinghamshire, Sheffield and Leeds, that had gone. So what we had last autumn was a service from a new station at Euston to Old Oak Common in West London, up to a brand new station in Birmingham, continuing up to a brand new station in Manchester, with the option of serving places like Liverpool and Preston by connecting onto the West Coast main line south of Manchester. That's where we were roughly a year ago. And then Rishi Sunak stood up in an abandoned railway station in Manchester and announced the cancellation of this brand new railway to Manchester. And one of the defining characteristics of that was that it really was just, we'll stop now. And anything that we've already nearly finished, we'll carry on with. And anything we haven't really made progress with, we won't start. And so you had a slightly arbitrary mixture of physical assets on the ground and train sets based on kind of where the contracts were. Is that a reasonable summary of what we ended up with?
Yes, it is. I mean, the comparison with France is interesting. The French have for many years worked to a grand long-term TGV plan. And whenever the funding was available, they'd build one more line. Everybody in government appears to have known for many years what the list was of which lines would get built. And they've gradually pecked away at that list and built an entire network across France, prioritised with the first one that was from Paris to Lyon. We seem to have gone about it the other way. We've announced a network and then gradually pecked away at it to reduce it to almost nothing. We've gone the opposite direction from having an ambitious network to having one short stub going from Acton in London to Aston in Birmingham. And that's about it. And then the industry has been told, well, you'll just have to make do with that and make the best of what's available. So that's where we've got to. We've got a misfit train fleet on order that isn't the best for the railway that's being built. And we've got significant capacity issues on some bits of the existing railway that are made worse by the construction of High Speed 2.
So let's talk about the track first. So at the moment, we don't have a funded plan for a new line into Euston. So HS2 starts in Old Oak Common in West London. It then runs through a very high specification new railway to Birmingham. And if you're going to Birmingham, it serves a staggeringly expansive new station in Birmingham with, I can't quite remember how many platforms, but significantly more platforms that will be needed for the service to London from there. Or you can connect back onto the West Coast main line. And there is nothing planned currently for north of Birmingham on the West Coast main line. It is the West Coast main line as last upgraded while you were at Virgin West Coast for the fleet of Tilting Pendolinos that currently run on that line.
Yes, I think the station at Birmingham Curzon Street is designed to have seven platforms. The train service that is currently proposed, in my opinion, a good operator could operate that from one platform out of the seven, leaving six platforms idle. So it is a very embarrassing white elephant.
While at the opposite end of the line in Euston, we have no platforms when we probably could do with a handful. Okay, so that's the track. And I think one of the points you made there about France is a really important point to get across here, which is that when they build a new section of line, of high-speed line, it's designed and planned how it will be integrated into the conventional line on each side of it. That has been deliberately assessed and chosen. Whereas the point here is that this bit of line was never designed as a standalone piece of high-speed infrastructure. And my understanding is that when the government was making the decision to only build this section of line, they didn't consult with Network Rail, they didn't consult with the National Infrastructure Commission, they didn't consult with the two metro mayors that would be affected by it. And so no one was given the chance to come up with an improved plan that would create a railway that might not be the full high-speed to vision, but at least was designed to be integrated into the conventional network.
Yeah, that's the version of the story that I've heard as well. It was a decision made in a great hurry. I mean, I think the important thing in France is that it's all part of a grand jigsaw puzzle. And each year, as funding becomes available, they build a little bit more of the big puzzle. So they make full use of the high-speed lines and the conventional railway lines. France isn't perfect. The railways there for TGV journeys are extremely good, but they don't have, in my opinion, the regional network that we have. A lot of the lines have two or three trains a day. A lot of the suburban trains are older, rolling stock. There's a lot that could be improved in France, but their TGV network is outstanding. And of course, has been in use since the early 90s and has grown year by year in a way that we can just look on in envy.
And it's very similar in Switzerland. I spent some time earlier this year with the planning and strategy teams of Swiss State Railways, and it's very similar. They have a very clear long-term vision of what they're trying to get to, and then incrementally they add, you know, connections, tunnels, bits of higher speed railway in order to build towards the timetable. And the team I met there are now working on the 2050 timetable, therefore to develop the next phase of that integrated infrastructure investment plan, which is a very different way from the way we've done it.
The Swiss way is notable in that they start with the timetable and say, what infrastructure do we need to deliver a better timetable? Not many railways are in that luxurious situation. The Swiss railways, in my opinion, are well funded and enjoy a long-term commitment from the democratic process that operates in Switzerland. But they do start with a timetable and say, right, we need another passing loop here. We need some four track here. We need a high-speed line here. And they work back from the timetable. Whereas we build and then think, what kind of service can we run?
Now, the infrastructure that we end up with as a result of the decision made in Manchester last year isn't ideal, but it's made far less ideal by the trains. So, and that's something I don't think most people have outside the railway industry have fully picked up, that the trains were designed for the platforms that were being built for HS2, and those platforms are not now being built in Manchester. Talk us through the implications of having the trains, which are already on order and being built, but not having the platforms in Manchester.
So the train order that has been placed is for 432 carriages made into 54 train sets. Each train set is 200 metres long and can be coupled together to make a 400-metre train. 200 metres is nearly 100 less seats than an existing Pendolino train. So clearly it's a challenge if you want to run between London and Manchester. London and Manchester is one of the busiest routes on the West Coast Main Line. In my time in Virgin, we basically took all the passengers off the airlines. Unbelievably, people used to fly between Manchester and London in quite large numbers. And we took them all off the airlines onto the railway with a successful service. Now, the platforms in Manchester are not long enough for 400 metre trains. So you either run 200 metre or 400 metre. 400 metre is too long. So you've got to run 200 metre trains when High Speed 2 opens. And that's 100 less seats on each service. So 300 seats an hour less than is currently provided on that corridor. You could order the 432 carriages in a different configuration. So instead of having 8 coach trains that are 200 metres long, you could have 250 metre trains. The trouble then is there won't be enough trains and enough carriages. So against this new train order of 432 carriages, the current Pendolino fleet is 574 carriages. So more than 140 carriages more. And in any language, whatever way you cut it, that's less seats than today. And that's what we're currently stuck with.
So we have a situation where we either have trains of the right length but not enough of them, or trains of the wrong length and sufficient but then not enough seats on those trains, basically.
Yeah, and at the moment, no plans to build 400 metre platforms in Manchester, which would be a big undertaking. You cannot just lengthen the existing platforms to 400 metres. If you just have a look at the approach to Manchester Piccadilly, the challenge of lengthening those platforms by more than 100 metres, right across the busy junction outside Piccadilly Station. I mean, the mind boggles that the work to do the platform lengthening would cripple Manchester for months while the engineering work was undertaken, even if it was the right thing to do. So there has to be a plan at some point to provide 400 metre platforms. And the mayor of Manchester does have a vision for that, with an underground station in the centre of Manchester that would provide for High Speed 2 and also for TransPennine services, which could be up to 400 metres long. And we would then see a big increase in capacity between Manchester and London.
So we know that we don't have the station we want in Manchester, potentially. I mean, if the mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, gets his way, someone might start work on that, I don't know, in the 2030s. We might have a new station in Manchester in the 2040s. That is typically how long things happen, if they happen as quickly as possible. And we're not going to have a new connection between Birmingham and Manchester anytime soon either, because even if that is reinstated, which the government said it won't be, or some other new railway, which seems more likely, something explicitly not called HS2, but an M6 relief railway is specified that runs on a very similar route, we're not going to have that anytime soon. And I think one of the things that you've been saying a lot is we need a plan for what happens when the first stage of HS2 opens that makes the most use of what we have got. And one of your concerns is that you haven't really seen evidence that, because the railway was handed over this random basket of assets that it didn't ask for, that that plan currently exists or is as optimal as it could be.
Yes, I mean, the creative effort of the industry and government has focused on the engineering, the building of the railway, and not on the operational and passenger proposition. And I've been a bit of a lone voice for much of this year, challenging the industry in particular to have a good plan for when High Speed 2 does open with its limited functionality. My plan is quite simple. The existing trains, the Pendolino trains, have a life expectancy to 2042. And in my opinion, they should be made full use of between when High Speed 2 opens in about 2030 and 2042, in order to keep seat numbers where they are today or provide more seats on every route. There is no reason why a Pendolino cannot operate on High Speed 2. They're already built to run at 140 miles an hour. They've been tested up to 155 miles an hour. And in my view, they can quite comfortably run alongside the higher speed, high speed two trains, as happens on high speed one, where Eurostar trains run alongside Javelin trains at a lower speed. So my priority is to provide the same or more seats on every route and a reduced journey time on every route between 2030 and 2042, in the hope that by 2042, we do have 400 metre platforms in Manchester and a new line at least most of the way between between Birmingham and Manchester that gets around the current bottlenecks. In the interim period, with the plan I've put forward, we can run 10 trains an hour from Old Oak Common and serve all of those routes. And that has a side effect that it runs far less trains, long distance trains, on the West Coast Main Line down through Watford into Euston. And that line from 2030 onwards can be refocused to provide more urban capacity between places like Milton Keynes, Hemel Hempstead and Euston. And it's no coincidence, of course, that the government wants to build more houses. And that is one of the areas suitable for building more houses. And I believe the railway should be doing more to support that house building programme on that particular section of line. We need to provide more trains, not just for commuters, but for people who live in that area to be able to travel to and from London. Milton Keynes to Euston non-stop is half an hour. We should be aiming to have a train every 5 minutes between Milton Keynes and London, many of them doing it in that half an hour non-stop journey time. And the train should be 12 carriages in length, providing the maximum seat numbers. And the longer distance train should be running into Old Oak Common in a little over 5 years' time. So I'm not talking about some dream of many years to come. I'm talking about a little over 5 years.
Okay, so talk me through. If we just do what was originally planned and basically run HS2 as originally envisaged, but with what we have got left, which is kind of the default option. So there's an HS2 dedicated fleet running on HS2 dedicated infrastructure. Talk me through what my train service would be if I live in a few places. So let's start with Manchester. What would it happen? What would my service be by default if we just do the HS2 plan as envisaged with the infrastructure we've got? And what would you, the plan be under your, what would the service?
Well, part of the problem here is that High Speed 2 and the government have never announced a new train plan since the cancellation of a year ago. So there is no published plan out there of what they can do or what they would like to do. And as far as I know, the plan, if it exists, has certainly not been made public. But I think one can guess at what might happen. So even if you can run three trains an hour from Manchester to Old Oak Common, each one of them will have 100 less seats than today. That will mean that there will have to be probably compulsory seat reservations. It'll mean that local passengers going from Stoke to Manchester will not be welcome on those trains. Imagine a busy Saturday when several Premier League clubs are playing. That's football, Thomas, by the way. Premier League. If the Premier League teams are mostly based in the Northwest and two of them are in Manchester, and on a busy day, all of those people will squeeze onto trains to go to and from the south of England. And there will be a lot less seats than today, both for local journeys and longer distance journeys. Birmingham is the one route that could benefit. So it would be possible to run 400 trains between Birmingham, Curzon Street and Old Oak Common. And it would be possible to run three trains an hour on that corridor. But it will still be possible to run that in my proposal as well. So Birmingham benefits. Liverpool, like Manchester, would have less seats. Glasgow would have less seats, about 100 less seats in every hour. And the train, whilst it will be quicker on High Speed 2, it might gain about 20 minutes on High Speed 2. It will lose at least 10 minutes because the train won't be able to tilt and run at 125 miles an hour north of Croome. So there are swings and roundabouts, but in most cases, there are less seats and the journey time gains are not that significant. With my plan, I'm proposing the same or more seats on every route and a reduced journey time on every route, all to and from Old Oak Common initially as an interim plan to 2042.
It does depend, doesn't it, on people being willing to treat Old Oak Common as the London terminus for high-speed, long-distance services to the northwest. Do you think that's credible?
Well, I don't think we have any other choice. If we try to run a mixture of some trains to Euston and some to Old Oak Common, the poor passenger will be completely confused as to where they need to travel from. And you could easily get a situation where lots more people want to travel from Euston than there is capacity available. So I think we have to plump for one option and then invest in it and develop it properly. I believe that Old Oak Common could meet that bill for the first 10 or 15 years if it has to. I believe that we could provide sufficient customer support there. We could provide sufficient facilities at the station. And of course, connections from central London on the Elizabeth line, which we know will have more services because the government has approved an order for more trains. So there will be 1,000 capacity train every 10 minutes starting at Old Oak Common, going into central London. Of course, if you're travelling to the Euston area or to Westminster, that's perhaps not quite as good as it is today, depending on how you want to travel. And if you're used to getting a taxi at Euston right to the front door of where you're going, that won't be such a realistic proposition from Old Oak Common. But of course, if you're going to Heathrow to catch a flight, Old Oak Common will be much better. You'll be able to change Old Oak Common, and within seconds, you'll be able to get a service to any of the terminals at Heathrow, which will take about 15 minutes from Old Oak Common. So a big improvement there. Also, if you're travelling to the Thames Valley and Reading, changing at Old Oak Common will be more attractive. So I think given a five-year lead-in, we can develop a good customer proposition at Old Oak Common, and then we can tell people about it effectively and properly market it, and it can be a success. And then hopefully along will come Euston 15 years later, just when the growth is reaching the point that Old Oak Common can't cope anymore. Euston will come to its rescue at that point.
One thing that would be very helpful is there are two overground lines that pass very close to Old Oak Common, both of which could have stations at Old Oak Common. I don't think that they're currently funded, and it would be very helpful if Old Oak Common is going to become the hub for services to the northwest, if people could access via the overground as well as the Elizabeth line.
Yeah, I mean, all of these things suffer from the constant changes of plan that have occurred over really the last 20 years of this scheme. One minute Old Oak Common is going to be an intermediate interchange station. The next minute is going to be a terminus for the whole of London and then back again. It's very difficult to plan an effective transport network in that sort of environment. And of course, it's not cheap to do that either. Every time you change your mind, it costs money.
One of the things about your plan is it has exactly the same problem in many ways that we were talking about right at the start of this conversation, of needing to explain to people that actually the place where you're making the change isn't the place that gets the big benefits. Because really, the key thing that you're doing is freeing up the West Coast Main Line entirely. And you've talked about Milton Keynes, so that places, and it's not just Milton Keynes, so that places like Coventry can have far better services than they have at the moment. And when everyone's looking at what's happening on HS2, actually the big benefit is if you live on the West Coast Main Line at the moment and you can have a service freed up from all those people going to and from Glasgow and Manchester.
Even your favourite line, the Chiltern line, gets a benefit out of this, because the Chiltern line has, over the last 20 years, fought for an ever bigger share of Birmingham to London, in competition with Virgin and now Avanti. Of course, when High Speed 2 opens, it'll be hard to compete, harder than today, to compete with a 49-minute journey from Birmingham to central London. as long as High Speed 2's commercial strategy is right, i.e. they've got cheap fares that match those of Chiltern, Chiltern won't be carrying anybody from Birmingham to London. And instead, all of those seats will become available for journeys from Bicester to London, Banbury to London, High Wycombe to London, all of those sort of things. So all of those passengers and the residents of that line will also benefit. Yeah, it's a complicated message to get across to, especially to the critics of High Speed 2, but it is a very important one. This is a railway network we're running. It's not one single line in isolation from the rest of the network.
Presumably as well, if you can persuade everyone that Old Oak Common is the London terminus and HS2 is now the North West Main Line, that also has benefits for congestion at New Street Station as well, which could have benefits for all kinds of other places, from Worcester to Shrewsbury, because where the New Street Station is so heavily congested by the presence of the long distance services from London.
It is. And yes, that is a further opportunity, as of course it would be in Manchester if we build a separate high speed station. There are lots and lots of benefits to almost every station on the network at the end of the day. But we will have to keep some long distance trains running to connect, for example, Manchester with Milton Keynes, Coventry with Euston. So it's a balance to strike. Coventry almost certainly won't have three high-speed trains to London every hour like it does today. But I don't see why it shouldn't have at least one that is non-stop from Coventry to Euston. So we can fit the other trains around that. And one thing we haven't mentioned so far at all is freight. Of course, if we remove some of the long-distance passenger trains from the West Coast Main Line, we can run lots more urban trains, but we can also run a lot more freight trains. A modern freight train doesn't stop anywhere and runs at 75 miles an hour, so it can keep pace with those urban trains. It can't keep pace with a Pendolino running at 125, but it can run in between the urban services. And the West Coast Main Line is currently Europe's busiest mixed traffic railway, and I believe could carry several more freight trains every hour. And each freight train is dozens of loaded lorries off the M6, M1 corridor. So it makes a big difference to the whole of the country.
So how are you doing? You've got a clear proposition, which is the West Coast Main Line becomes effectively a local railway. HS2 becomes the main line to the northwest, and we provide the capacity we need by putting the whole train fleet, including the Pendolinos, onto the HS2 service and speeding them up. Is that vision one that people are buying into? Is it who needs to make the decision? I mean, there's so much complexity at the moment. Do you even have a sense as to whether the world agrees with you and this is what's going to happen or not?
Well, my aim 6 months ago, having devoted a big chunk of my career and my life to this bit of railway, I couldn't sit by and do nothing. And I felt obliged to use my experience and my contacts to put an alternative plan out there and start a debate. The very fact that you're interviewing me and that I've received so much coverage in the trade press shows that I've started that debate. And the recent mayor's proposal for Birmingham to Manchester mentioned me by name. So I'm very pleased that I've started the debate. I am neither in government nor in charge of one of the big bits of the railway, so I can't deliver my ideas to reality, but I can stimulate others to consider it. And I believe I've done that. What happens next is down to the government and the industry to decide where to go with High Speed 2. And I do think we're on the cusp of some important decisions about what commitment government is willing to make to High Speed 2. But I stress my interim plan for the first 12 to 15 years of High Speed 2 requires no investment whatsoever in the Network Rail infrastructure. And on High Speed 2, it just requires them to finish what they're currently building. So I'm not arguing for millions of pounds to be spent on anything. I just want the Pendolinos to carry on operating, to carry on being maintained in the way that they are today, and the High Speed 2 trains to get built and introduced. And then let the operators make the most of what is already ordered and being built in order to provide the very best service that we possibly can.
One very final question. One of the things I've noticed in your work on this over the last 6 months is there's almost been a slight resistance from some people. I've seen some comments along the lines of, we don't want to let them get away with something suboptimal, almost like, because no one intended Old Oak Common to become the London terminus, even for only a decade. And no one intended the high-speed service to terminate at Birmingham and the West Coast Main Line to have to be used so intensively further north. And all of these questions, there's been a slight sense that if you come up with a viable operational plan, kind of they've got away with it and we shouldn't do that. Is that something that I saw a few comments like that. Is that something you've experienced as pushback while you've been working on this?
Yeah, I have experienced that. And people have said to me, well, you shouldn't come up with a compromise plan. You should just tell the government they've got to build and build and build. Well, we've got to live in a real world. And the worst thing that can happen to the industry is this thing opens in a little over 5 years' time and we provide a really poor service, which is not reliable and provides less seats than today. That will completely undermine any case for building more lines in the UK and will become a global embarrassment. So we need to live with what we've got and make the most of it. And yeah, you know, I can understand people's frustration about changes of plan and the end outcome that we're living with at the moment. But we've got to package that up and get on with providing the very best service that we can. And I think I've proved that we can do that. And it's going to be a mixed network, whether we like it or not. It cannot be a pure high-speed 2 network. And there are lots of people out there who think that the old railway somehow pollutes the new railway and makes it less valuable and less effective. Well, I'm sorry, I don't get that at all. A passenger sitting on a train really doesn't care whether they're sitting on high-speed 2 or network rail. They just want to get from London to Manchester as quickly as they can without standing, and when we say they're going to, for a reasonable train fare. And that's the kind of thing we've got to overcome. And we've just got to provide the very best service that we can.
A great summary to end on. Chris Gibb, thank you very much indeed for joining me on the Freewheeling Podcast.
Well, that concludes the Freewheeling Podcast for another week. My thanks to Chris Gibb and my thanks to you for listening. If you enjoy the Freewheeling Podcast, do go on to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and give a rate or a review so other people can find us. And please have a listen again next Thursday when we have another edition. Many thanks. Bye.